Okay, we got up to slide 13, which is obviously a graph. You see that it's free energy versus progress of the reaction. Progress of the reaction is another name for time. So that means that any individual point on the trace, one point, the y value is g, right? That's free energy. Now, before I get into what's important about this graph, what kind of reaction is this? How would you classify this energetically? No, it's exergonic. Because it's releasing energy, right? You end up with lower G than you started with. That G, that energy that's decreased in the system, has to go out into the surroundings. It's an exergonic reaction. Now, this is a generic example. A, B, C, D are, they can represent anything, basically. But in any given chemical reaction, reactant gets turned into product, right? So for any given chemical reaction, there are some bonds, chemical bonds, that need to be broken and some bonds that need to be formed in order to turn reactant into product. In other words, reactant doesn't just immediately transform into product. There is somewhere in between reactant and product that the system has to go through to get from reactant to product. And that kind of halfway stage is called the transition state. It's not reactant anymore, but it's not yet product. Somewhere in between. That's why these squiggly lines appear. They are bonds that are in the process of being broken so that new bonds can be formed like the ones you see in the products. And the transition state, whatever it is, which depends on the particular reaction, is a very unstable situation, which is why it corresponds to high G. The free energy, or the G, of the transition state for a reaction is bigger in value than the G for the reactants or the products. Now, this is an exergonic reaction, but you could draw a corresponding endergonic reaction. Just the difference, of course, would be you start with lower G, you end up with higher G, but between that, you have a higher G than either the reactants in the product, called the activation, the transition state. In other words, this transition state, energetically speaking, is an energetic hill that you have to climb in order to make any reaction occur. The one in the graph is endergonic. You can tell that just by looking at it, but you can also see that it has a negative delta G, right? You end up with lower G than you started with, therefore G final minus G initial is a negative number. That means exergonic, but what does that also tell you about whether this will happen? Right, this is a spontaneous reaction, which means it at least can happen on its own, right? That's what spontaneous means, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. And this graph tells you why a reaction that is spontaneous isn't necessarily going to readily happen. Because even a spontaneous reaction has to get over this hill, energetically speaking. Once it gets to the top, then it will easily go downhill to the products. But you have to get to the top of that hill. And the thermal energy of the system might not be enough to actually make that happen easily. But the size of the hill, in other words, how much higher it is than the reactant here in this graph, gets its own special name, which is the energy of activation, or E sub A, or just activation energy. Any given reaction features some value of activation energy. Now, importantly, the size of the activation energy is not involved with or depend on at all the delta G. The delta G for any reaction depends only on the G for the product and the G for the reactant. Nothing about in between. So graphically speaking, delta G is simply that difference in final and initial G's. Nothing to do with this hill. The hill itself is a separate energy difference, which is called the energy of activation. This graph, the black trace seen in this graph, the only trace, is for this reaction to occur without the help of an enzyme. In the next slide, we see exactly the same graph for the black trace, the same reaction with the same activation energy and the same delta G, but the red trace is the same reaction occurring with the help of an enzyme. We've already talked about enzymes quite a bit. They are catalysts, right? And catalysts speed reactions up, usually at least millions of times. Well, this graph shows you why an enzyme speeds up a reaction. Because what an enzyme accomplishes, and different enzymes accomplish this in different ways, but what every enzyme accomplishes is a reduction or a decrease in E sub A, a decrease in activation energy. In other words, the hill gets smaller. And if you get that hill small enough, then the thermal energy of the system will be enough to get you over that hill. And therefore, the reaction will occur much more readily, a lot faster.
You said E sub A, so it's E sub A.
E subscript A, like this. Another important thing about this, related to what I was saying in the previous slide, is that enzymes affect only activation energy, the size of the hill. No enzyme ever affects delta G in any way, because like I said in the previous slide, delta G depends only on the G of the product and the G of the reactant. The enzyme does not change that. Okay, well, let's look at an enzyme in 15. This is a generic example. It's no specific enzyme, but for any given enzyme, which is a complex molecule, all enzymes are proteins and they're complex molecules, that has an overall complex shape, but there is a particular part of that surface that is really the business end of the molecule as far as what it does. It's called the active site. The active site is the specific place on the surface of an enzyme where the substrate binds. Now keep in mind that substrate is really just another name for reactant in a catalyzed reaction. The substrate is the reactant that binds to the enzyme in order for that reaction to get sped up. Okay, so in other words, without the help of an enzyme, we say a reactant gets turned into product. Same thing happens with the enzyme's help, but we call the reactant substrate instead. Because to get to the product, it first binds to the enzyme. This is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? All enzymes are proteins. Something, a particle that binds to a protein is a ligand, so a substrate is an example of a ligand. And by now you should be used to the drill. What is the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein? Changes shape of the protein. Correct. So this is no exception to that. You can see here that there is already a pretty good correspondence of fit, of shape, between the active site of the enzyme and the substrate. This is why enzymes are specific, by the way. This is why this enzyme will work for this substrate, this reaction, but not others. So the fit is already pretty good. But since this is a ligand, the substrate, binding to a protein, the enzyme, that means the enzyme is going to change shape when that happens. And that change in shape, which is what is illustrated in this cartoon, is called induced fit. Now think about what induce means. It means to bring about, right? To cause. So induced fit refers to the fact that the binding of a substrate to an enzyme induces or brings about an even better fit than you had originally. You can see that on the right side. Now the fit is even better because the change in shape of the protein caused by the substrate binding makes the enzyme wrap around the substrate even tighter, excluding the substrate from the surroundings even better, isolating it, making it even more likely that the reaction can occur. And this is very much like a strong, active handshake versus a weak one. Right? You can just offer your hand and not make any motion, or you can be someone who really grabs the other person's hand. That's what induced fit's like, a strong handshake. All right, 16. Another cartoon of an enzyme, but you see the same enzyme in several times drawn as a cycle. That's the cycle here is important to indicate what I've said already about catalysts in general, which all enzymes are, right? They're catalysts made out of protein. Catalysts are not reactants or products. They don't get changed into anything. They are therefore reusable. Well, the substrate or substrates in this case too come in and bind to the active site. That changes the shape, and that change in shape is what helps bring about the lowering of the activation energy. All enzymes operate by lowering activation energy. In this case, this is what? An anabolic or a catabolic? Well, you can't really tell from this, but there could be either way, right? If you have a catabolic enzyme, it's breaking one big thing into smaller pieces. Maybe the binding of the substrate with the enzyme and the induced fit stresses the bonds so they can more easily be broken. That would lower the activation energy. If it's an anabolic one where two substrates combine, maybe the two substrates are brought just into perfect alignment with each other for them to react with each other. Whereas without the help of the enzyme, they'll just be bouncing off of each other and not necessarily in the right orientation. The point is, enzymes do the reduction in activation energy different ways, but they all reduce energy of activation and they all change shape during this cycle. But when the product is produced, it's released. There's no ligand bound to the enzyme anymore, so it snaps back into its original unbound shape, ready for another round. As long as there's more substrate, the same enzyme molecule can be reused over and over. And by the way, it's going to be reused over and over as long as the enzyme exists and as long as substrate exists. Sometimes this is not really what the cell wants. Yes, it wanted the help of the enzyme to a point, but maybe it wants to shut down that reaction now that it's gone on long enough. Well, if the enzyme still exists, it's going to still work. And so it's important for a cell to be able to control enzymes. Cells control reactions and the pathways that they're part of by directly controlling enzymes. There's two major ways a cell could do this. If it wants to shut the reaction down, one way is to destroy the enzyme. If you destroy the enzyme, obviously it's no longer going to work as a catalyst, right? So it's going to shut down the reaction. And that will certainly work. But if very soon after you need that reaction to be turned on again, well, you can't use that enzyme anymore. It's destroyed, right? So you'd have to go back to the gene, get the instructions for how to build RNA, put in the time and expense of building RNA, and then put in the time and expense for translation to use that code to build a new version of the enzyme, the protein, That takes not only time, but energy. And so that is, even though that will work, that's not necessarily a good method for controlling an enzyme. It would be much better, in other words, to have enzymes with switches, and you could just temporarily turn them on or off as the need arises in the cell. And there are such switches that we'll talk about. One of which we don't have pictures for, is phosphorylation. If you think back to the chapter that included the functional groups, I gave you several different indispensably important reasons why phosphate has to exist for organisms. One of those is phosphorylation. Not just enzymes, but other proteins as well, but particularly enzymes, get phosphorylated and dephosphorylated, meaning a phosphate gets hooked onto them or taken off of them. And that is a way, that's one way in which enzymes can be switched on or off. We'll look at other ways in a second. First, though, let's go to 17. Look at a couple more graphs. The only thing different about these two graphs is the x-axis, temperature above and pH on the bottom. And remember that I've said already that temperature and pH, which are just two of many variables, are particularly important variables because a change in either one of these, a change in temperature or a change in pH, can drastically affect the shape of proteins. And that's a big deal because proteins have their function because of their specific shape. If that shape is changed, then the function is compromised at least. Might not be entirely disabled, but it's at least made not as good. And that goes for enzymes, which are proteins. So in the top one, rate of reaction on the y-axis refers to how fast the reaction is occurring, which is another way of saying how well that enzyme is doing its job to speed that reaction up. You have two traces, one for each of two enzymes that are different molecules in different organisms, but they're the same kind of enzyme, meaning they are catalyzing the same reaction just in two different organisms. The black one from a human, the red one from a thermophilic or heat-tolerant bacterium. These thermophilic bacteria not only survive temperatures of boiling water, which would kill almost anything else, but they thrive at those temperatures. They do better than at other temperatures. So the human enzyme, notice, peaks out, and the peak is important because that peak tells you the optimum condition. That peaks out, though, at about 38, which is the average human body temperature. This is by no accident. This is by natural selection, right? There are different versions of this enzyme that randomly occurred by mutation over the ages, and the one that works best at 38 degrees is the one that got selected for in humans. If you get a temperature lower than that, not as good of a job at speeding up the reaction. Higher than that, not as good. So any given enzyme has an optimal temperature, the temperature at which it works best because it has just the right shape. Well, at 38 degrees, notice that's such a low temperature for this same enzyme, in a different version of this same enzyme in the bacterium, that it's not even working. You have to get it up to temperatures that would kill a human before it works best. And similarly, on the bottom, you have the fact that any given enzyme has an optimal pH. The pH that works, that allows that enzyme to have the right shape to work best, represented by the peak of the trace. In this case, though, the two enzymes are both in humans. They're both doing the same job, but in different places in the body. The black trace is from the stomach, where the pH is very low because of the high acidity due to the fact that the epithelium in the lining of the stomach produces hydrochloric acid. So the optimum is under 2, which is very acidic. When we eat food, it's food only until we swallow it, and then the contents of the stomach, which is more than just food, is called chyme, and that doesn't stay there forever. But it's while it's in the stomach, it's at high acidity, low pH, and therefore this enzyme is doing it's optimized for stomach contents pH. But when that chyme then gets passed to the next thing in line, which is the small intestine, there's a drastic change in pH. So this enzyme gets destroyed because it gets denatured by this higher pH, closer to neutral in the intestine. That's no problem that you lose the function of that enzyme, though, because a different version of that same enzyme produced by the lining of the small intestine is optimized, has an optimal pH that matching its surroundings, its new surroundings. Okay, 18. Everything we've been talking about up to this point in terms of operation of enzymes and the fact that substrates bind to them at the active site and get turned into product, that's all illustrated by normal binding in this figure. So that's not new information. What is new information is in the other two, B and C. And in the middle cartoon, we have what is called competitive inhibition. Inhibition refers to making the enzyme work not as well. In other words, deactivating it, turning it off, which is really important because if you turn off an enzyme, you effectively turn off the reaction because reactions don't require enzymes, but they happen so slowly without the enzymes that they're effectively turned off in a cell in the time scale in which cells live. So that's what inhibition in general is, the turning an enzyme off and therefore turning off the corresponding reaction. But this is specifically competitive inhibition because you have two particles competing for, in a sense, the same spot on the enzyme. That same spot is the active site. In other words, the place where the substrate, the reactant, normally binds. All right. So the substrate itself, which is the reactant, is one of those two particles competing. The other, in blue here, is called a competitive inhibitor. It's not a substrate, and it will not get turned into anything by binding to the active site of the enzyme. It has enough of the same shape as the substrate, though, that it's able to fit in there instead of the substrate fitting in there. And that's why it's called competition. When an inhibitor binds to the active site instead of the substrate, that effectively takes this particular enzyme molecule out of the game. Now, always keep in mind that there are thousands or millions of copies of the enzyme, not just one. But this particular version might as well not be there at the moment for as long as that inhibitor is bound to the active site. It's inhibition simply because the inhibitor blocks the active site so that the substrate can't bind. The enzyme is there, but it's turned off. And it will remain off, or inhibited, as long as the inhibitor is still bound to it. But that's not forever. It can unbind as well. Well, you can also have inhibition, though, happen non-competitively, which is what C is showing. For an inhibitor to be non-competitive, it has to bind to the enzyme somewhere other than the active site. You can see that happening in the cartoon form. The red thing is a non-competitive inhibitor binding to this place, which is not the active site. The active site is up here. If it's not binding to the active site, why would an inhibitor inhibit the enzyme? Why is the enzyme turned off now? The active site is still open. Why won't the enzyme work? Well, let's go through the drill again. What is this non-competitive inhibitor an example of? A ligand. It's binding to a protein, the enzyme. And therefore what?
The shape is changing.
The shape of the protein is changing, the enzyme. So the shape change is such that the active site, even though it's still open, is now deformed. It doesn't have the right shape now, and they could have drawn it a little better because it looks like it still kind of fits in there pretty well. But it doesn't fit in perfectly anymore. And so, yes, substrate is there, and yes, active site is open, but it can't bind. So this enzyme in C is just as inhibited, just as off, as the one in B, just for a different reason. They're both inhibition, in other words. Well, that's one way of controlling an enzyme, namely to turn it off or inhibit it. And some enzymes are normally on when they're not bound to anything and can be turned off, in other words. That's what we're looking at here. But it's also possible for an enzyme to normally be off and it has to be activated. And we'll look at that in just a second, but first, before we change slides, make sense of this in your mind. If the control is competitive, well, first let me give you a different term for non-competitive. Non-competitive is one way of controlling an enzyme. And if it's non-competitive control, we can also call it allosteric. So allosteric control or regulation of an enzyme happens by binding of that particle somewhere other than the active site. That's what makes it allosteric or non-competitive. What I was asking you, though, to make sense of in your mind is that if the control is competitive, then it can only be inhibitory. In other words, it doesn't make sense to think of competitive activation. Or does it? Does that not make sense to you? Why does competitive activation not make sense? Well, what does it have to be true for it to be competitive? It has to bind to the active site. And if it's binding to the active site, it's blocking. Therefore, it has to be inhibitory, right? You can't block the active site to activate it. You're blocking it. That's what I meant. Does that make sense? Well, blocking is a consequence of the binding if it's competitive. Because competitive binding means the binding is particularly at the active site. And therefore, there's something in the active site that's blocked. That's why it's blocked. Because that inhibitor is already there. The substrate can't come in.
It's so, not like a ligand. It doesn't change shape, though, right?
It is a ligand. It's not only changing shape, but even if it didn't change shape, it would still be blocked. Simply because it's there, it's in the way. And that's why it can't be activation. It's always going to be in the way by definition of being competitive. On the other hand, if it's non-competitive, then you could turn the enzyme either on or off, depending on the particle and the way it changes shape, and depending on the enzyme. So allosteric regulation can be either inhibition, turning it off, or activation, turning it on, which we see in slide 19. Now this is an enzyme, this is a multimeric protein, whereas the other ones were not, that we looked at those cartoons. This is a multimeric protein because it's made up of four individual polypeptides complexed together, right? Each polypeptide features its own active site, so it's really four enzymes in one, able to process four separate substrate molecules simultaneously. But anyway, notice the double arrow here, labeled as oscillation. There's two different shapes that this unbound enzyme without anything bonded to it, can assume. It goes back and forth between these two shapes easily because they're basically at the same G level. There's not one one shape that is energetically much more favorable than the other. So it just goes back and forth all the time. But notice that in one form, the active sites are totally different in shape compared to the other form. Therefore, only one of these is the active form of the enzyme, meaning the right-shaped active sites so that substrate can bind, and the other one is in the inactive form, going back and forth all the time. Well, until you have an allosteric regulator come by, and there's two types here. The green thing is an allosteric activator. First of all, it's allosteric because where it binds on the enzyme is not the active site, somewhere else. That's what makes it allosteric. But when the green thing binds, it locks this oscillating enzyme into the active form and keeps it in that shape. So now the active sites are all correctly shaped and staying in the correct shape, allowing for substrate to bind. Whereas the red thing, if it comes along, binds a different place, but it's still allosteric because it's not the active site, and it locks it into the inactive form. So even if there is substrate here, it's not going to get into the active sites. This one is off. This enzyme is off. This one is on. Okay? That's an important way in which enzymes can be controlled. This dispenses with the need to destroy the enzyme, which is, like I said, takes energy and time to build a new one. All right, so the final slide, 20, shows you an example of the control of an enzyme. This is a real example, even though it doesn't matter what the real example is, but in this case, the initial substrate, meaning the starting molecule, is threonine, and threonine can be stepwise produced in a pathway, so a five-step pathway, into isoleucine. That's the end product. Each step requires its own enzyme, as we've already discussed, as you can see them listed here. But the main focus of the slide isn't the example, it's that pathways can be controlled through feedback by what is called feedback inhibition. Now think back to feedback as a general concept, which we studied long ago. There's two major categories, right? Negative and positive feedback. Which is the more prevalent of the two? Negative, because negative is the only kind of feedback that can lead to homeostasis, right? In other words, that can negate or decrease an error. Feedback mechanisms involve an error, which is a difference between the set point and the real value. Well, let's think about this pathway. The intent of the pathway is to transform threonine stepwise into isoleucine. This would be appropriate to run this pathway if the cell needs isoleucine for whatever. Right? It makes isoleucine via this pathway, so if the cell needs isoleucine, this pathway should be turned on. And as long as the cell continues to need isoleucine, the isoleucine will continue to be used up as it's being produced, and it will not build up. Does that just make common sense to you? Okay. So there is no error in that case, as long as it's running and as long as the cell continues to need it. Eventually, though, the cell will have enough isoleucine, and that's where the error will be produced. The error will be too much isoleucine. Because when the cell no longer needs it, like I was talking about before, these enzymes will still be there. They'll still be running the pathway, even though the cell doesn't really need the pathway. So, in other words, isoleucine will start to accumulate. And here's where the feedback inhibition comes into play, because isoleucine itself is acting as an allosteric inhibitor. Specifically an allosteric inhibitor of enzyme 1 in the pathway. That's why it's called feedback. It goes back to an earlier position. Okay, so this is just like the red thing in the previous slide. Isoleucine, which is the product, will itself bind somewhere other than the active site on enzyme 1, changing its shape, deforming the active site, so it can't be used anymore for this first step of the pathway. If you shut down any one of these individual steps in the pathway, you shut down the whole pathway. So it doesn't... you could deactivate any one of these five enzymes. It would still accomplish turning off further production of isoleucine, which is appropriate, right? Because you already have too much. You want to shut down the pathway. But usually, in feedback inhibition, it's the first enzyme that gets shut down, not the other ones. Now, why does that make sense? Or why would the cell not want to shut it down at 2, 3, 4, or 5? Yes, because if you shut it down at 5, say, you're still going to go through all of these intermediate steps, even though you don't need them. You'd be making all these intermediates for nothing, because the only purpose of ever making them is to get to the end product. So it would be wasteful, waste of time and energy to do that. If you nip it in the bud up here by turning off the first enzyme to operate, you still accomplish the goal, which is to stop production of isoleucine, but you do it more efficiently. Now, the cell doesn't have to think about this, right? It just happens automatically when isoleucine accumulates. The more there is, the more likely it is that it will interfere with enzyme 1 and turn it off. And then later on, eventually, the cell will start using isoleucine again, and the stockpile that accumulated earlier will be slowly depleted. And the more depleted it gets, the rarer it gets in solution, the more likely it is that the isoleucines that are cooked to the enzymes will diffuse away from the enzymes, unbind from them, and those enzymes will go back into their original shape with their active sites open, and the pathway will automatically turn on right when it's needed, and then turn back off again after you produce enough again. So that's feedback inhibition. Any questions? All right, that's a chapter.